Hey everybody, my name is Devin. I am a recovered alcoholic.
Hi Devin.
Can I ask, is this the first meeting you guys are having back in person? We've been doing, okay, good. I'm really happy to be here. I'm really happy to be in the same room with you guys. I've really struggled with this whole screen thing. And I'm really happy just to get to kind of share. I have a couple of weeks. I'm not here next week, but then I'll be here basically for the rest of July. And hopefully we'll have some coherency through that. But I am a recovered alcoholic. I have a sobriety date, which is August 28th of 2011. I have a home group, which is called No Serenity Till Brooklyn. We meet in Brooklyn, New York. We're still currently virtual because our landlords have basically said, hang out, wait, we'll let you know. But we do have five meetings a week. And I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's cool to get to do workshops like this because I actually get, you know, we get to dive a little deeper than just like tell your story. But I don't know about you guys, but I have this thing where I don't just listen to people right off the bat. I'm like, you know, a skeptic. I'm defiant. I kind of think everyone's kind of lying a lot, or I used to. And I find that the magic of what makes AA AA is that we identify with each other. And I just opened to the end of the foreword of the third edition, and it reads at the very end that each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. You know, I remember talking to my sponsor about, you know, what is AA one day, and he just asked me that question. He said, well, what is AA? And I was like, oh, well, we have the meetings, and there's the book, and there's these steps. And he goes, yeah, but what is it? And we kind of sat for a second. He goes, is it not just one alcoholic talking to another? Obviously, one of those hopefully has had some kind of an experience and has something to offer where we talk to each other at the bar all the time. But doesn't really get us much. But like one alcoholic talking to another, and if one of us is recovered from this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, have an ability to reach in and touch someone at a level that is untouchable by most other people on the planet. And that's really cool. And so that's hopefully what we're going to be doing over these next couple of weeks. It's one alcoholic addressing a group, and then you guys will get to share. And I'm really looking forward to hearing from everybody. But I need to let you know a little bit of what it looked like to get me here, because I don't listen to people I don't think are drunks. I might look at you and be like, this person, what did they do? I'll try to do this as brief as I can. But, you know, I'm that kid. I was from the Midwest in Indianapolis, outside of Chicago is where I grew up. And in second grade at 8 years old, the teachers noticed that I was up and down. I interrupted them. I interrupted the students. I had to always be moving around. And they basically told my family, we need to go evaluate this kid. So they sent me to a doctor who at 8 years old felt like he's got ADHD, which in the 90s meant put him on methamphetamine, essentially. So at 8 years old, twice a day, I was getting basically methamphetamine over the counter, right? Doesn't make me alcoholic, but it kind of shows that like from way before I even took a drink, something was just a little funny. And I remember as I grew up, this might be normal for a lot of people, but I would see a reflection of myself in the mirror and I thought I looked funny. And if I heard myself talking on a recording or through a microphone, I sounded funny. I didn't know how to laugh. I listened to how you laughed. I gotta figure out how to hold my hands when I'm standing in a circle with you. Like, something's just off and something's wrong. And I don't really know what that's about. And furthermore, I don't have a mirror to understand that there's any other way to feel. And when I got that mirror was when I took a drink for the first time. You know, the first time I drank, my friends and I, we grabbed a bottle of gin from my buddy Ray's parents' liquor cabinet. And our intention was to get was to see what happens when what are people feeling with this? You know, and we downed a bunch of shots really, really fast. And I had this amazing experience where alcohol wiped away all that uncomfortableness that I had. You know, I've heard people describe it as for some reason, all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, my skin fit. You know, and I remember I sat back on the couch and I looked at my two friends and I wasn't wondering what they were thinking about me. I didn't care what they were thinking about me. It was just like I found something that I felt like I'd been missing and I didn't know I was missing it. But up until that point, you know, there was no way to understand that. And I didn't immediately, some people immediately they have that and it's like we're drinking, you know, a bottle a day immediately at early age. You know, I had a really great family. There's no alcoholism in my direct family. There's no drug addiction in my direct family. It's just me. And they would do the, like, we're not angry, we're disappointed routine a lot. So I didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want to disappoint them. Because they were really loving family and they tried to do everything they could for me. But by those later teen years and towards the end of high school, it became, this is what my plan is to be doing on a regular basis. And by the time I was 18, I was an IV drug user. They caught wind of that. It was like an undercover narcotics officer on Mother's Day grabbed my phone and called home. I had a flip phone. I had a home button. And he was yelling at my mom about all the stuff that was going on. They were like blindsided. You know, and they threw me into one of those 8 or 28 day like lockdown inpatient things, and you know, and I ended up being in like about almost 90 days of forced abstinence. And you know, I'm 18 years old, and I don't know about you guys, but I didn't have a problem until I had a problem. I was unable to understand that I had a problem until one day it really dawned on me that like I'm screwed. But that day didn't come until years and years later. At 18 years old, what I had was a misunderstanding with my family. And I looked at it from my perspective and I said, you guys don't understand what I need to do to be okay. And I have this ability. One of the things I also sought a lot was approval. I was really good at being able to figure out, who do you want me to be? What do you need me to say? What role do I need to fit into in this group of people to get X? And I was able to do that in that facility. I was able to figure out what you wanted me to say and how you wanted me to act. I looked at the kids that had been there for 3 weeks and what did they say, and the counselor's nodding and smiling, and I just stole his words and mangled them into my own way, and all of a sudden, early on, the counselors are nodding and shaking when I'm sharing, and I'm in the back of my mind going, cool, like this is how I survive. You know, this is how I survive until I get to the next drink. There was no intention of change ever happening, right? And I ended up, against all the advice of the people in this facility outside of Chicago, my family sent me to this music school in Boston that I'd been accepted to on a scholarship. And the first night I was there, somebody down the hall said, hey, we got a case, you know, we're hanging out if you guys want to meet the floor. And I was in there and I took a drink, and the next 6 years of my life happened. You know, I took one drink after some opportunity was put in front of me to be sober, and 6 years just evaporated. The cool thing about that little forced abstinence was I did meet you guys. And Alcoholics Anonymous was doing service in that facility, and you guys were showing up a couple nights a week, and you guys were doing meetings. And I got to understand that there was this thing called AA, and I went to meetings, and I became aware of it. You know, this book I actually got in that facility when I was 18 years old. It's fallen apart now, but I got it way back then. But in the briefest terms, I got to this music school, and I took a drink that first night. It took a couple of months, and then it was basically I'm drunk and high the clock round. I became the guy selling a bunch of drugs at a music school because that finances a lifestyle that I needed to have this drawer full of cash. You know, there's consequences that come with that, and I was unable to say that, you know, to see that these consequences might be because I needed to be drinking the clock round. I just didn't connect those dots, and I continued to go on this thing, and you know, so the parents got more phone calls from police. And it just got weird, you know? It gets weird when you're a drunk. The drug thing kind of was this never-ending cycle that came and went, and I didn't really know what my problem was. And I ended up in Brooklyn, New York. I was going to change everything in my life, and Brooklyn was going to be the change. I'm going to go from Boston to Brooklyn. I'm going to be this, you know, I got to get my life on track so I can do this music thing, and this is going to be it, man. And don't you know, the first night I was there after moving in, I went to my friend's house, and it was everything that I thought I was going to like walk away from right there in this one, you know, this one room. And shortly thereafter, I was really unable to do any kind of work. I got put on to help a band on tour as like their tech. Ended up spending a week in a county jail in Georgia because, you know, we got pulled over driving the U-Haul with all their stuff, and, you know, turned out that, you know, I had things that the state of Georgia didn't like. So I ended up in this county jail in a town of like 1,500 people. I got arrested by an officer named Wilbur. I thought that was a pretty low notch on the belt. You know, they spray you with lice killer. They give you the rubber boots. You're like, awesome, man. This is great. And again, you know, how disconnected from reality I am is I sat there for almost an hour after I was in the population, and they have the phones, the pay phones. And I sat there for an hour trying to figure out, how am I going to call my family and softball in where I'm at? Now, if you've ever been locked up, you know it's a collect phone call. And if you've ever made a collect phone call, the automated operator lets the people that are picking up the call know exactly where the call is coming from. And so they got this automated voice saying, you know, you're getting a phone call from an inmate at the McIntosh County, you know, correctional facility. Do you accept these charges, you know? And it was one more time that I'm causing a lot of damage to the people in my life. Some people use that term deafening silence. That's what was on the other end of that phone. You know, it connected and it was just silent. And I heard the voice of a defeated mother say, what is it now? You know, and so this is kind of what my drinking started to look like. The way that I had to live started to look like. And ultimately what ended up happening was I started waking up with a suicide plan. I don't know if you guys have ever had the suicide plan. That was becoming plan A. Alcohol was no longer giving me the relief that it once had. Our book talks about we come to a place that we call the jumping off place. And what that looks like is we can't imagine life with or without alcohol. And when Dave was talking to me about a topic, and I hate picking topics. I think I'm the worst topic picker. Because the way my brain goes, it just kind of goes. And so I'm going to get into the reading this stuff, but I'll jump around a lot. You know, because the way my mind is kind of connected all this stuff is it's like it's all kind of working in concert with itself. Maybe that is that ADHD thing. I don't know. But we came up with this topic of our shared dilemma. And I wanted to really talk about what is alcoholism. You know, and when I get to this idea that alcohol, I can't imagine a life with or without alcohol, what I'm really left to wonder is like, well, what's really going on here? You know, what is alcohol treating? What did it treat that first time I drank? You know, what was removed from me that first time I drank? And then why do I end up, you know, why do I throw everything that I've ever had essentially on the table to be let go of for this relief? You know, what's really going on there is not just a drinking problem. And that was something I didn't understand. And so hopefully we'll look at what the book says on some of this stuff and we can kind of start. I was told to read this thing and if they make a statement, turn it into a question. And I was told that this is a book that is merciful and it contains truth. You know, and so if I'm willing to kind of engage with it, let's not argue with the ideas here. Let me just take it as truth and fact that these people have had these experiences and this is what they followed and this is how they recovered, and just ask myself, am I willing to bring enough willingness to the table to try what these people did? Am I willing to accept some of these statements from the doctors and from the early people that recovered from alcoholism as fact and just try to do what they were doing? That's the only thing I've ever done right in this program, I think, is I've been willing to continue to try to grow. So to get to the end of how I end up in AA, I'm waking up with suicide plan. I can't imagine life without alcohol because when I'm sober, I'm miserable. I mean, I almost think if we pulled each other and we asked, well, what's the problem when you're drunk or sober? Most of us would say, well, when I'm sober. I'm in so much pain internally when I'm sober that I have to drink. But yet when I start drinking now, I'm not getting any relief from this pain. And towards the end, when alcohol will turn on you, it actually starts making it worse. And it makes it worse in two ways. One, it doesn't kill the pain that I'm trying to run away from. And two, I can't show up to the responsibilities of life. And I start letting down people in my life over and over again. And it's like that sound on the phone with my mom. And she picks up and she literally is just silent. Because she understands the gravity of the situation, and one more time she's having to figure out, what do we have to do to help my son? You know? And that hurts. That hurts a lot. So I didn't know what alcoholism was. I have the suicide plan. And the grace that I got was that I remembered that AA was even a thing. And I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one day. And this was in northern Brooklyn in the neighborhood of Greenpoint. And I showed up. I was 24 years old. And I walked into a neighborhood, and it was like everybody was 65 and up. And I looked around, and I was like, what is this, the Neighborhood Grandparents Association? Like, what is this, the community board? And I literally said, like, this can't be my life. Like, this literally cannot be where I'm supposed to be. And I met some people, and I shared, and some guy was there, and he said, you should hang out. You should stay. There's another meeting after this. It's a men's meeting. And there's going to be a different group of people. Like a different. You should stay. And I remember, I think I was like, you ever like, I bummed a cigarette from the guy. I didn't want to just be rude and take it and run. So I was like, I'll humor this guy for the cigarette and then I'm out of here. But some people were like coming up on bikes and they were walking up and they were like younger guys. And you know, just all of a sudden it was like, oh, maybe I could relate to some of these people. And I stayed for that second meeting. And this is early June of 2011. So about 10 years ago, right? And hopefully this will get us into some of this doctor's opinion stuff and this like alcoholism like foundational stuff. I got acquainted with what powerlessness really is from that early June of 2011 until that date of August 28th of 2011. And here's what happened. I went to the meetings and I'm going to try to put this in. And just this is my experience. I went to these meetings and the message that I heard in these particular meetings that I found in the beginning, it was like, hey man, I'm screwed. I can't stop myself from drinking. There's all this other stuff going on. My life is a mess. And they would basically say like, hey man, you know that drinking thing? Yeah, just don't do it. And I was like, that's the magic? That's the AA answer? Is just don't? Oh, just don't drink. Oh, great, thanks. Like, I could have just thought that one up, you know, 5 hours ago. Now I'm here with you guys. You're just saying, hey, just put the plug in the jug. Just don't. And I can't just don't. And I can't just put the plug in the jug. And I found that out because I came to these meetings. And I don't know what brought me back to the meeting almost every day. But almost every single day I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was around people that were sober. And I was talking to you guys. And I would hear, you know, here's my phone number. Call me if you feel like drinking. You know, oh, okay. They're like, sometimes we do this an hour at a time. Sometimes we do it a minute at a time. You know, but like, just don't pick up no matter what. Join the no matter what club. And my experience was no matter what I drank. Every single night I was almost, without a fail, I was in a blackout. And I kept waking up and I was like, when is this going to end? And I wanted to die. You know, I know today you can't scare a drunk. Because sometimes people will be like, oh man, if you keep drinking, you're gonna die. And it's like, good. I want to die. I want to get out of here, man, because this sucks. And I need help. And so... For whatever reason, that was what I was being shared in the meetings, you know. But there were people that seemed to stay sober. And hearing somebody that had almost 10 years of recovery, I was like, that guy's lying. You know, 5 years, like, I just don't believe you. But there were some people that had like 7 days. And then they would raise their hand and say, I got 14 days. And I would be back on saying, I got 2 days or whatever, you know. And I was like, well, that guy somehow stayed sober this last week. Like, maybe I could stay sober for a week. And the amazing thing about when one drunk talks to another is I heard stories. And this is why I'm telling a little bit of my story. Because hopefully some of you guys will be here for these following weeks. And I want, you know, more of this stuff will come out. But then we can start from this place of identification, hopefully. But what happened when I heard your stories was I started to believe that you guys weren't lying to me. And I started to hear people speak a language about how I felt that I didn't even know. They were able to describe how I was feeling and put vocabulary to internally the struggle that I had. And then I looked at them and the message that I at least got was, this guy somehow is sober. This lady has somehow made a life. I see how you drank. I understand how you're drinking. I understand how you're feeling. And somehow you are sober today. And you are carrying this message, maybe not through what you're saying, but through the simple fact that you are up there sober, letting me know that it's possible to stay sober. And so on August 28th of 2011, I was at a meeting. It was my morning meeting. It started at 1 p.m. It was called High Noon. I couldn't get out of bed before 12:15. If you're drinking to like almost alcohol poisoning every night, you know that before noon is not really happening. Or if it's happening, it's just me puking up stomach acid, because that's kind of where you're at. And that's what it looked like. And so I would get up and I'd go try to grab like an iced coffee, which was probably not good to drink on my stomach, and go to this 1 o'clock meeting. And for some reason that day, I stared at the floor for the entire meeting until they asked if somebody needed to share. And my hand went up and I got called on. And what I heard myself tell this room full of people was, I'm effed and I don't know what to do. But if I'm not surrounded by you people at another one of these meetings, I will be drunk by the end of the night. It's going to happen. It's been happening every single night. And we stood up and prayed shortly after. And I'm not I didn't grow up with a church. I didn't have like religion in the home. I didn't really have spirituality in the home. I wasn't looking for God. I wasn't excited about the idea of higher power and God and AA. I mean, I was just kind of like, all right, whatever. Like, we'll figure that out, you know. But I didn't have anything to draw on. But when I stood up and I grabbed hands with some basically strangers and we started to say the Serenity Prayer at that meeting, I got the chills down my spine. I told you I went to a music school. And music has always given me that reaction. And when I had this physical reaction to music, I never questioned if I was in the right place. It was just like, okay, this is for me. And here I am in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm having this physical reaction to whatever I just said in this prayer and whatever's going on. And the message that I got was, this is for you. And from that day on, AA has just been for me. And I got to learn. My first sponsor, we went through the 12 and 12. It was like a couple of years of writing lists. I don't really know what happened, but I got brought to a place after that experience where I said, I'd like to look at this big book and do another round of steps. And I want to go a little deeper if there's something more to know. And I found a guy who basically said, we're going to go through this process and it's going to go as quick as you're willing to do it. We suggest that the sooner that you get into this, the better. And he goes, my job is to make it crystal clear so that you understand at every step of this process exactly what you're doing, because your job at the end of this is not to go live a great, wonderful life, although that's probably going to happen. But your job is to go and share this with somebody else that I won't be able to get to while I go get somebody else. And from the very beginning of going through the steps out of the big book, it was brought to me that the goal here is not about self-help, but it's about working with others. And that really, if I'm willing to put my life on the plane of how do I share and help somebody else to recover, that I actually get everything that I felt like I was missing from the beginning. And so that was news to me. And what's also was news to me was really the depth of what alcoholism is. So all throughout the beginning of this book, we have a doctor's opinion. And the doctor's opinion is literally this guy named William Silkworth, who is a doctor at Charlestown's Hospital, which is in the west side of Manhattan on like the upper 80s and the upper west side, right on the Central Park. And he was in charge of, in like the mid to late 20s to the mid 30s, he was in charge of the alcohol and drug addiction unit there. So he saw thousands of drug addicts and alcoholics coming in. And he was also the doctor to Bill, who was one of the founding members of this. And he had some observations, right? He had been seeing chronic late-stage alcoholics up in his unit for years, and he had some observations about his limitations as a doctor, but also the way that he saw alcoholism presenting in symptom form through these people. And so I was sitting here, and I was calling myself an alcoholic, but if you had said, well, what is alcoholism? I wouldn't have been able to stop and give you any kind of an idea. Well, I guess I drink too much, and I got some DUIs, or, you know, I'm going to look at my consequences of my life and try to pin that as my alcoholism. And when I sat down and started looking at what this book says, it talks a little bit differently about it. It lays out the idea that alcoholism is threefold in nature, which was news to me. I mean, I knew that I didn't have an off switch. I don't know if anybody feels like, I felt like I came out the gate without an off switch. And what the doctor has to say about that, I'll just paraphrase it. I'll read a little. What's amazing about his observation about those of us that seem to not be able to control how much we drink once we start is he likens it to an allergy. And a lot of times, if you've been around a while, you've probably heard people use food allergies, right? I don't know if anybody's allergic. Is anybody allergic to peanuts or shellfish in here? No? All right, well, good. We can go eat all the good stuff. I've never had a friend who's allergic to shellfish, like, kind of nudge me and say, like, do you think I should get the shrimp cocktail today? Yeah, like, he's able to make the connection that shrimp cocktail, or any shellfish for that matter, equals anaphylactic shock, equals I'm not eating it. But this doctor says, look, what I see with late-stage chronic alcoholism is once these guys start drinking, they're overcome not on a moral level, not on a, oh, I'm just going to keep going and, oh, screw what those people said, but on a physical level, we're driven to continue to drink it. And that was, I mean, when I heard that, it was like, oh, that explains so many experiences in my life. That explains why when I went to visit my sister at her, you know, like parents' weekend in college, and we got an opportunity to drink, and they poured me like some drink, and I started drinking, and they just kept handing me drinks, and I just kept drinking. And that night ended, all I remember is puking in a trash can the whole night, and then puking up green stomach acid the next morning. Now, I have a wife who's sane. And what I mean is she's not alcoholic, she's not a drug addict, she's like literally a sane person. She can convey how she's feeling and her emotions with like clarity and simply, and doesn't hold on to. I mean, she's a sane person, and I've seen her get drunk to the point where she was needing to throw up one time in almost 8 years of us knowing each other, and it was about 4 years ago or so. And it happened once, and she was like, "Wow, I'm never doing that again." And to this day, she has not even ever come close. I mean, so she has the ability to recognize, well, that was a little too much, and then she was able to rein it in. But she still drinks. But the way she drinks is, she'll pour a glass of wine, and I'll come into the kitchen an hour later, and it's sitting on the table half drank. And I will literally pick it up and walk into the other room and look at her and be like, hey, did you want this wine? And she will look at me with like, oh, the wine. Oh, yeah. Oh, I forgot. And I'll take that here. And the damnedest thing is that in the morning sometimes I'll wake up and you'll see the drying line of the red wine where it dried overnight because she didn't actually finish that glass. I've seen her open bottles and go, oh, this is kind of bad, and just chuck it. Last October, she bought a six-pack of like the October pumpkin ale. And I went to put the six-pack in the fridge because that's, I mean, we're gonna need this in the fridge, right? And she was like, oh, I'll get them one at a time. 3 weeks later, she grabbed the last one and put it in the fridge. I mean, that's like what sanity might look like. When she starts drinking, she's not overcome by an allergic reaction. When she starts to get a little buzz on, she goes, ooh, I need to slow down. My experience is when I start to drink, I need more drinking. Way in the beginning, one of the first parties I remember getting invited to, we got a case of Coors Light. I had the 32 rack or whatever, 24, 32 rack. There was three of us that paid for it. I'm the one carrying it around the party. I know where my next drink is. It's right here in my hand. I mean, you know, this is from 16, 17, like this is how I drink. I need this. Is different than I want this. Is different than like maybe I'll have a drink later. Because my wife's more like, maybe I'll have a drink. Oh, I'm good. I mean, well, you know. So this idea though that once I start drinking, something happens in my body starts to explain what's going on. Why is it that I would leave with the intention of like, I'm going to hang out with these guys and I got to wake up in the morning and I got to handle my stuff. And now it's like 4 a.m. and I'm like, oh, I guess I got to drive home now. And I don't know what happened. Where did that 8 hours go? You know, it starts to explain. And the amazing thing is that he says that this is limited to this class of drinker that we call the chronic alcoholic. That if I've ever experienced a craving, come on, once I start, doesn't have to be every time. If I've ever, I'm probably already on the line, on the other side of the line in the sand. Now that's really amazing. He even goes, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Right. The "and once having formed the habit" for me is really important. Later on, when he goes in to talk about the different types of drinker, he talks about the moderate drinker, which is kind of like the me joking about how my wife drinks. She's a moderate drinker. She could take it or leave it. Then he talks about a certain type of hard drinker. And the hard drinker might look like an alcoholic, might need a medical detox to get out because he physically might be shaky. But at a certain point, the hard drinker has the ability to stop, manage, and control and change and live different. They say maybe the doctor gets involved and says, your liver is going really bad, dude. Like, we got to be careful. Maybe it's, you know, you found her or you found him, you know, the guy or the lady that you were waiting your whole life to meet, and all of a sudden you snap out of it and you start getting... I mean, I have a buddy. This is his deal. We were partying together all through college and we get to Brooklyn and one day this guy showed up. He rode his bike like 5 miles across Brooklyn. He's like in shape. He's all smiling. I met this girl who's now his wife. You know what I mean? 10 years later, they're married. They got a house in Connecticut. Like, I go on tours with this guy, and he'll have like a glass of wine every once in a while. And in college, it was like we were hanging hard, man. He has the ability to manage and control on some level and change his life and actually put that plan into effect where it can stay. But when he talks about the real alcoholic on page 22. He says, we might start out as a moderate drinker. That's on 21. I'll just read it. He goes, what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some point or some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. And once having formed the habit, right? If I've ever seen my drinking go and my body react like this, I don't have to go to the end of the line. If I'm willing to ask, do I have that physical reaction? Now, I think Bill writes, like, the tragic truth about these chronic alcoholics is that most of us are never going to realize that we have this problem until we're way, way down the road. And that's me. I mean, I could see this way back when I first started. It took a good chunk of years of, you know, drinking and the drugs and that whole thing for me to realize, like, I think I have a problem. And I maybe need some help. And then it still took another chunk of time to actually surrender that I understand how to help myself and to let you guys help me. I didn't understand that that was this physical thing. I didn't understand that that was part of this dilemma that I'm in. Then they go on. So I mentioned this allergy thing, right? If we're looking at, okay, so I know I don't have an off switch. I know if alcohol is the problem and it's in the cup, it's not a problem then until it gets in me. Great. The question that kills me is how many of us were able to stay stopped on our own? How many of us were ever able to make a decision that, I can see that alcohol is a problem, and I guess I just need to stop completely. And I'm going to live that way from now on. I've never been even close. Now, there's a story in here about the guy of 30. And they mention, there's one of these chapters, chapter 3, more about alcoholism, talks over and over again, the way I have a little thing written on the top of it. It says, stories about the mental obsession. But they go on to talk about this guy who, at 30 years old, realized that drinking was a problem. He spent 25 years achieving everything in the business world, stayed sober until 55, gets home, kicks off his slippers, brings the robe out, and in 4 years he's dead. He's in multiple detoxes, and he dies of alcoholism in 4 years. Mm-hmm. So, to that end, let's find out what else is going on. Because if I do have the ability, like the man of 30, to stop for a prolonged period of time, I might actually be fooling myself that I'm okay. So if alcoholism isn't a drinking problem, what's my real problem? And we draw the conclusion here that it's my thinking. And this comes to, again, where I'm going with this is, if you read how it works, there's the ABCs of how it works on page 60. And it gives us, up until this point of the book, we hope we've made clear of these three ideas. The first one is that I'm alcoholic and cannot manage my own life. And for those of you that end up in a detox, or some of us go to treatment, or we're told by our families or by therapists, you're an alcoholic. My first step is not somebody telling me I'm alcoholic and then I start saying I'm alcoholic. My first step is when I conceded to me that I was alcoholic. And I needed to understand what alcoholism was and the full extent of it in order for me to even be able to do that. So do I have this physical piece? Doesn't have to happen every time, but if it's limited to alcoholics and I've ever experienced it, well, then maybe I'm in that camp. And so then they go on to say, if you are in that camp and you do have this physical allergy, well, it would stand to reason that if I'm able to have that, they just say, we know that, an alcoholic keeps away from drinks, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. And then they give us, to me, what's the atom bomb, which is these observations that, once I start drinking, something happens to me. That observation would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink. And how many times do we hear that? It's the first drink that gets you drunk. It's actually it was more like the seventh. But what they're talking about is if I don't end up drinking, I don't have this physical reaction where I can't stop, therefore I may be okay. But they offer that to that question, how many of us could stay stopped? It's like I've gotten burnt on stoves a couple of times, and usually it's an accident today. I don't find myself looking at the stove and seeing the electric red hot stove and be like, maybe today, maybe it's not that's not happening, right? I'm able to. It's like as a kid, it got wired up. That's bad. Don't do it. But for some reason, when it comes to drinking, I'm not able to connect that. That wire doesn't connect. It's like, you ever been overseas in Europe? They have different power plugs in every country. I'd be on tour and I'm like, which adapter do I need? I'm trying to figure out how to plug in my phone and I don't have the right adapter because it just doesn't fit. And that's kind of the way my brain is. You guys tell me, hey, drinking's a problem. Hey, look at all these consequences. Look at what happens. Those tears of your mom and your partners and your families, you don't mean to do that, but let's stop it. And the reality is we can't just stop it. Because we have a mind that doesn't seem to function properly. And I wasn't, that was another piece that when someone brought to me and they said, what we suffer from as alcoholics is we have a mental obsession. And I didn't know what the word obsession meant. I have a sponsor who is one of those guys that will pull out a 1930s dictionary and look words up from back then. And he found a definition of the word obsession that reads like this. Being ruled or possessed by an evil spirit from without. Now, if that's what I'm up against, if I'm being ruled or possessed by an evil spirit from without, means like something outside of me is coming in and controlling me, then I must have some kind of power to combat that or else I'm screwed. And that's what we're kind of talking about here. We don't really talk much about denial with alcoholism. I mean, people do. But we talk more about delusion and obsession. And delusion and obsession are literally, I can't... You say something about my condition and I just can't... I can't understand it, literally. It doesn't connect in that way. And so, if my problem was alcohol, I just don't drink, I'm fine. My problem is I can't leave it alone. One of my heroes would say, you know, I've got a body that can't handle it, and I've got a mind that can't quit. You know. And that's where I found myself. For the 3 months, that was the state of my life. I woke up every day and I said, tomorrow I gotta do something about this because I gotta drink today, and then I start drinking, and once I start drinking, I'm touching this part of me that needs to keep going. I'm not looking for a little bit of a buzz. I'm looking for just oblivion, because the only way I can actually get away from this pain is a blackout. They say that spree is going to be repeated over and over again unless I can experience a psychic change. And I was thinking, a guy that I've been working with for a couple of years, him and his wife and his two kids just moved over to West Orange from Brooklyn. And I got to go and visit him on the way. And I was just... like, you know, washing up before I was out of here, and I was thinking about the topic of our shared dilemma. And it struck me that part of our shared dilemma is that the only answer that AA's ever had is that you got to find a higher power. And a lot of us don't like that answer. You know, we come here and it's like, man, I got all these problems, and it's like, well, dude, you got to find a God of your understanding. And you're like, that's it? That's what you're throwing at me? And like, I don't want to do that. So part of our shared dilemma might be that not only do we have this alcoholism thing, but if I really am a chronic late-stage alcoholic, I have to also face the fact that the only real solution available to me is a spiritual answer. We call it God. Luckily, there's no AA God. I mean, think about that. Like, you know, my experience of this whole thing called God has been a slow, evolving thing over almost 10 years. I came here, you told me to do stuff, I started doing stuff, you suggested I ask myself questions about prayer, meditation. You told me I have to stop pointing the finger at everybody else and look at me. You know, that I got to go clean up my stuff, all the wreckage back there, I got to go address that. You know, those people I stole from and the people that I ruined their lives, I actually got to go and show up like hat in hand and say, hey, I harmed you and I was wrong and I'm here to try to figure out how to make it right. And then you guys promised that if I was willing to do that, that I could live free of the suffering of a mind that keeps bringing me back to a drink. And that the amazing thing would happen, that if my mind wasn't bringing me back to a drink and I wasn't actually drinking, that spree cycle of this like never-ending thing would actually stop. And that was something I really wanted, but I didn't really get that message until I was about 3 years sober. You know, so I look at it today, it's like I got this amazing grace and that surrender experience, and I learned all this stuff, and I went back and I said, wow, I had that mental obsession the whole time. I had that physical craving from almost the very beginning, but I just didn't have the information. And I don't even think I had the ability to comprehend the information until I was desperate one day, until I was willing to actually go out and try something new. And so, recently, I've been starting to ask this question, which is, what drives that mental obsession? And I wanted to, again, there's this whole, in our first step, we don't have a step set, but the first step reads, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol. And then there's a dash, and it says that our lives have become unmanageable. And I get to see my powerlessness over alcohol in the ways I was kind of been hopefully describing through some stories, right? If I start and can't seem to stop or manage how much I'm going to drink every time, that's a problem. If I had power and choice and control, every time I started drinking, I would be able to just drink exactly what I set out to drink and stop. Can I do that? Do I have that ability every single time to do that? I don't. Then the other question, have I ever been able to say, knowing that that's a problem, maybe being apprised of that information and looking at the consequences of my life, was I ever able to effectively change my relationship towards drinking by stopping or moderating? I haven't been able to ever do that. I got brought to this meeting and I'm back raising my hand saying I got one day and I don't know what to do. And when you guys said alcoholism is a spiritual malady and a spiritual illness, I didn't really understand that. Malady is just a fancy word for illness, right? And what does it mean to have a spiritual illness? Do you remember when I was talking about, and I saw a bunch of heads nodding, right? I was talking about just feeling uncomfortable. I don't know why, but I just feel broken on some level. I look, and here's what I do. I look at you guys, and I make up a story that you guys all got your stuff together. And you guys all look great, and you seem to be able to socialize, and you've got a nice car, you got a family, you got a job. I look at you, and I assume that everything in your life is perfect, and then I look at me, and I don't have a perfect life, so something's wrong with me. The reality is we all have a bunch of stuff going on. You know, we're all human beings, and we experience this full spectrum of emotion. I'm not exempt from that, but as a kid and growing up and in active alcoholism, I'm looking at everybody else, and I'm judging how I think you really are doing based on how I'm perceiving you to look, and all that's going through this faulty thinking. And I create this identity for myself that I'm less than and I'm not good enough and there's something wrong with me. And I think that that is really my alcoholism. I mean, it's part of me being a human being. And they talk about how, you know, we're extreme examples of selfishness and self-centeredness. But I take that, and what I've seen most of the alcoholics I know is we take that stuff and we just run with it. And what I found out is that unmanageability does not necessarily mean in my stuff on the outside. Unmanageability is more an internal condition, for me at least. And so how do I know if my life's unmanageable? And there's a couple of things that are really helpful for me. One is at the bottom of page 44 in the chapter to the agnostic. And this is where we get that word about our dilemma, right? The sentence down here says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. What does that mean? What's a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life? Well, a mere code of morals is like, I think this is right, I think that's wrong, I need to live different, you know, I'm not going to hurt those people anymore. You know, this is how I want to live my life. A better philosophy of life is, you know, I want to go out and be a good person. I think if you pull everybody in this room, no one's going to say, I mean, maybe there's a sociopath in here, I don't know. But no one's going to actively be like, no, today I want to go out and like destroy my family. You know, today's the day that I want to go out and wreck a car and take some guy in a motorcycle and put him in the ICU for 6 weeks. You know, no one is out there, I think, maliciously doing this stuff. Right? We have these philosophies of life. We have morals, usually. We have usually something in here that lets me know what I'm doing is wrong. But I don't have the ability to live different. And that's why they say, we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral, we could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient, they failed utterly. So my real dilemma here is I don't have power. I don't have power to stop myself from starting drinking, I don't have power to stop once I've started drinking. I also don't have power in my life to just go live different. I hear a lot of people talking about I'm changing me and I'm working on all my stuff, but like, dude, I can't do that. You know, if I try to work on me and change me, I usually end up coming out worse than I was before I started. I need to have some power here. And this is kind of on back on 44, what it says is, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. You know, and this is why I think this is kind of our main dilemma. Yeah, I need power. But what's that going to look like? I think surrender when I come in here is a way of weakness. I think people of faith and religion is that's some kooky, weird stuff that, you know, like, I'm way too smart for that. Because I got a dad who's really smart and he, you know, fell away from his church and said whatever he said about it. You know, maybe I'm not open to the idea that I need a spiritual solution because I don't understand how deep this problem goes. And so on page 52, my heroes have pointed to me as here's a great checklist to go, how am I doing today? And they pointed to this paragraph in the middle that talks about why not being open to apply, you know, a willingness to change to our human problems. And they ask a series, well, what I do is I ask them as a series of questions, and we call them the bedevilments a lot of the time. And I was told that this is more a description of that unmanageability that maybe I should be searching in my life to see if I have. And it says, we were having trouble with our personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Now, I don't have all these all the time, all at once. But these things crop up on a semi-regular basis in my life. You know, am I having trouble with personal relationships? Do I have conflict in my life? you know, one of my friends goes, "How are you doing with MasterCard?" It's like, "Oh, I wasn't thinking about the IRS or money." You know, like, that's personal relationship. How am I doing with my wife? How am I doing with my coworkers? How am I doing with my friends? Is there conflict showing up? Maybe I've got some internal unmanageability in my ability to interface with the people about me. Can I control my emotional natures? What does that look like? I guess if I wake up in the morning and I'm feeling okay, am I able to hold on to that and be okay? Or like when that guy cuts me off, is it like horn and finger and swearing? You know, like, can I control my emotional natures? Or am I kind of like, as they say, we were a prey to misery and depression. You know, am I hunted by these things? Do I find myself being like, you know, we get diagnosed as bipolar all the time. We wake up, everything's great. Then like something happens and it's the worst thing in the world. You know, I'm like on both poles of this extreme. They say we're hunted by this stuff. They're like, in my natural resting spiritual condition is not one of peace. Silkworth in that letter used restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness, right? And so for me, that's everything. If I'm restless, what does that mean? For me, it's like wherever I am, I got to be somewhere else. You know, I'm in the room with you guys, but really I'm waiting to get out of here because it's going to be better out there. You know, 5 minutes from now is better than now because I'm not around you people. You know, like restless. What's irritable? You know, every little thing seems to be just kind of, it's like I've got this bruise and you're constantly just kind of, someone's just pushing on my bruise. Everywhere I go, I got, you know, people talk about the rock in your shoe or whatever. It's like everywhere I go, something just seems to be frustrating. And when I think about discontented, the question I always ask is, do you have any joy in your life? You know, what do I wake up and actually end up having a full heart and feel some joy? I didn't have any of that. I walked around with this dark cloud. You know, I hated people. I hated you guys. You know, I was miserable. I was restless, irritable, and discontented. And what I found was a solution with drinking. It started to take that away. And I believe that because that's my resting spiritual status of restlessness, irritability, and discontented, the 8-year-old kid interrupting teachers, interrupting kids, standing up, sitting down, can't sit still, I found a solution to that with my drinking. And the problem is if you're alcoholic, it's a horrible solution. Because we end up having this physical component where we can't stop. And along the way to drink to that point, my mind gets wired up. That no matter what's going on in my life, good, bad, or indifferent, alcohol is the answer. And I believe that my real problem, when I say I'm an alcoholic, I'm trying to encompass all of that. I was told to have an active relationship with the first step. Because, and people say it's the only step you got to do perfect. I don't know about that. Like, I conceded to me that I was alcoholic. And I didn't know any of this information. I just knew that there was nothing I could do to fix this problem. And when I got brought this information, I was able to look back on it and get a lot of clarity and say, I've had this all along. And the good news about that, because this is kind of bleak, right? Like this is basically saying, you're screwed. And I hope, you know, if you're in here, I hope you're screwed. Not in a malicious way. Because Alcoholics Anonymous in this program, it works if you're willing to get involved and do it. And what I was promised is if I was willing to seek this relationship with a higher power, through the 12 steps. You know, I don't have to figure out God. It actually tells me in the book, I'm never going to understand or fully define. I said I'll never be able to fully comprehend or define that power which is God. So I was directed to not even try. So I have not been trying to figure out God. But what I've been trying to do is what this thing suggests is to seek God. And how I've done that was first I followed the direction of somebody that said, here's what I did. I did these steps. I followed the directions. We have a book. It's got the directions in it. I don't have to, you know, he's like, if you think I'm telling you something wrong, just go find it in the book. I'll tell you what page it's on. He's like, or you just go figure it out. Read it and find out where all these directions are. But I'm going to show you how I do all these things. And so he led me on this journey. And the promise that I got is when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And that comes right around the fourth step stuff. But it lays out that if my problem is that I have a spiritual sickness, where I'm naturally restless, irritable, discontented, that manifests in the mind and it manifests in the body once I start. The program is not here to address my relationship to alcohol. The program is to address my relationship to my humanity. And that's what I suffer from, is I can't live as a human being with all the ups and downs with any kind of like actual success, unless I am living what this program is asking of me. And the good news is it's super simple. We pray, we meditate, we look at ourselves, we call it inventory, some people call it self-examination. We get involved in trying to look at, what am I angry at, resentful at, what am I afraid of? You know, how have I been treating people in intimate personal relationships? You know, what kind of secrets do I have? What am I like burying that I'm unwilling to talk about? Usually sex stuff. I don't know why, but it's all, we always got some weird sex stuff going on. Not going to tell you about that one. But we got to get this stuff out, right? We got to get it out because that's what's been killing me. And they talk over and over again about how we're trying to present ourselves to the world as someone we're not. And what I know is that I know me. The good, the bad, everything I've ever done, I was there. Unless I was in a blackout, and I don't know. But for all the times I was conscious, I was there. And I have to live with that. And how I've been able to live with it is I got involved in this program. I pulled all the stuff out, found out what the garbage was. And then the amazing thing happened is when I started going and trying to clean it up through the amends process, and then when I started really getting asked for some help and being able to start, you know, what we call sponsorship, like people said, hey, I'm screwed and I need to do this program. Can you show me? All those things that I had felt were negatives in my life became positives. Because I can sit across the table from someone and before they even share, I say, here's all the stuff I was never going to tell anybody. And I just fire away at them all the things that were the deep, dark secrets that I had all this shame about. And I watch them kind of melt into this and they go, okay, this is what we're doing here. It is a drastic program. And I think that's part of why our dilemma is, are you willing to accept a drastic program? You know, some of us have defrauded the government. We've stolen from organized crime families. We've committed crimes that we end up in jail for. Like, we have done a lot of stuff out there. And no matter where you come from and where you start, you know, the program goes and it asks of us to do what we need to do. So it can be really drastic. And I've got friends that have made amends to organized crime families in New York. And I mean, you know, I've gotten to hear stories of people going and doing the thing that I can't do. Stand in front of a judge expecting 5 years of prison only to get told, well, whatever's going on in your life seems to be working just fine. I don't think putting you in jail would be ridiculous. You know, so I've gotten to witness when we do this stuff all in, the amazing happens over and over again. One of my heroes says we're in miracle country. And that's what this program has given me. So as we move, I think we're about at 7:30, so I want to shut up. But as we move into the next couple of weeks, I'm going to hopefully talk a little bit more about coming to believe, the second and third step stuff, and maybe get a little bit into just some of these practices of how we can maybe be using this program to seek a relationship with God. Because while the book is the book, God is the answer. The steps lead me to God. The book gives me like this is how I do this, but the real answer isn't that I can quote pages. The real answer is when I'm out in the world and life is in my face, am I turning to my God and saying, I need help? Am I willing to question what's going on, to own what's happening with me, to live a transparent life? Am I willing to do that out in the world, not just in here? And the only way that happens is if I practice it. And we come together here so we can, you know, it's like the huddle. And then we like, all right, play ball. You know, we go out into the world and we come back here and we huddle up again and go, how are we doing? You know? So I hope this is making somewhat of sense. I really wanted to, you know, our buddy being his first meeting, dude, I mean, welcome. You don't ever have to take a drink ever again if you don't want to.
Huge relief.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, man. I mean, you know, this, you don't even, I mean, we can't even comprehend how awesome life can get. It turned me from a guy who literally woke up wanting to die to, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm married, I've been able to travel the world playing music, I've played on Broadway in New York City. I mean, I've gotten to do all this stuff that a guy like me should never be able to do. And it wasn't that I went out and sought it. I just showed up one day and I was trying to stay sober and then the phone rang. And then I showed up and I tried to do what you guys taught me. I was early and prepared and then the phone rang again. And it's literally been just people inviting me into their lives. And because of this program, I was able to show up and people were like, actually, we kind of like this guy. You know, and they'd continue to call me. So there's a promise in here that you can walk around free. And we don't have to suffer because we have this thing. But if we're willing to do this program, we can actually be freed up. And that's what's happened to me. You know, I've recovered from that hopelessness that I walked in with. I don't have a mind that's like telling me, go drink. You know, I mean, every once in a while you walk by and I'm like, oh yeah, that kind of looks nice. But that's nowhere close to being possessed or ruled by an evil spirit from without. You know what I mean? That's like I look out and I go, yeah, I did that a lot. And I bet those people are enjoying having a drink right now. But I still have sanity to understand that if I put that in me, I have no idea what's going to happen. And because I haven't done that in almost 10 years, you know, my body has pretty much rejuvenated, I think. And it's pretty awesome. So thanks for letting me be here. I'm excited to be back with you guys over the next couple of weeks. And I'm going to turn the meeting over to you guys.